CataractCoach.com podcast series, episode number 70 with Shannon Wong, educating both patients and surgeons via his YouTube videos. Welcome back to our Cataract Coach podcast, and I have a very special guest, Dr. Shannon Wong. You've seen his YouTube videos. You've seen him at the podium in many meetings. And so, Shannon, welcome to the podcast. I've even done your podcast a few years ago.
That's right, Uday. Thanks for having me.
Oh, my pleasure. Now, tell me, you're probably most well-known for an amazing library of basically YouTube videos. How'd you start in this?
It is about 2010. Our kids were younger at the time. They were into YouTube. And I thought, well, what makes a YouTuber interesting? Their life and what they do. But I knew that there weren't very many ophthalmologists posting stuff. So I go, well, ophthalmology is pretty interesting. And so I started making some videos. And then I actually contacted you. I have an email from you at the time. And I said, because you were posting before I was.
Right.
And I sent you an email. I go, Uday, how do you do these videos? And you wrote me back. And I just kind of started doing it. Just life in the office and interesting things that I see that I thought the public might be interested in viewing.
Well, that's an important subject that you like to engage with the general public. Well, my videos are essentially all very much geared towards ophthalmologists. But you have a lot of videos about a lot of our cataract and refractive technologies aimed at patients.
Right. I mean, there's how many? 20-something thousand ophthalmologists, but there's 7.5 billion people. So I wanted to reach a wider audience. So I make some videos that are physician-oriented, surgeon-oriented, but a lot of videos I make are for kind of general public awareness. Also, you know, a lot of people post on social media like Instagram, and I'm not even on TikTok, but they post on TikTok, and I want to kind of keep it more real, and I just post that kind of content on YouTube. And, you know, I go to these meetings and I see a lot of these key opinion leaders, and sometimes I think they're very biased in what they say because they are being paid by certain companies to promote certain products in a certain way. And we've been around long enough to see how people's statements age over time. And I just wanted to be frank with doctors and the general population. So that's kind of how I frame my videos.
You know, that's actually very interesting. So I remember you're one of the early adopters of a femtosecond laser for cataract surgery, but then also one of the early unadopters of it. Tell me about that.
So, you know, we evolved during our careers, and we were doing LASIK in the late 1990s when it was booming, and that was a wave of technology. And then we got the Intralase in 2002 for LASIK surgery. And then 2012, we got a Lenzx femtosecond laser for cataract surgery. And we thought we'd ride that wave of technology. In fact, I remember I called another ophthalmologist who's very, very well known. And I said, why should we do this? And he said, you know, Shannon, I think the public will demand that our cataract surgery is done with a laser. And I go, okay, well, that makes sense. And I trust your opinion. And so we took the plunge and we did it, and it worked, but I developed a lot of complications from laser cataract surgery, anterior capsular tears that migrated posteriorly, just weird things that would happen that I wouldn't see with manual cataract surgery. We did it for a decade from 2012 to 2021. And then I visited another surgeon who's a high volume surgeon in the Dallas-Fort Worth area. And he was charging what we were charging and doing much more volume. His conversion rate was as high as ours was for premium IOLs, and he didn't use femto. And so I go, ah, well, the public really doesn't demand that we do femto. Why do I need to do that? It's only slowing me down, adding cost. So I abandoned it at that time. And my complication rate has gone way down since I'm not using it.
That's a good point. Again, every technology has plus and minuses. The minus there is, of course, that the little perforated, micro-perforated edge of the capsulotomy is not as strong as the capsular excess.
That is correct.
Simply put. But yeah, it's important to separate, as you're saying, the kind of the marketing and the commercial message from the reality of what you're actually doing.
And I think we both learned that over our careers. We've seen all the marketing messages, and we know how things age over time and how history judges these statements made by the marketing messages made by companies.
No, that's for sure. And so I think you and I think the same way with regards to like our patients and whatever surgeries we're offering is I just want to offer the best. I want to offer you the best for you across the board. You don't have to worry. Every step of the way is going to be like top of the line. And I don't think the patients really want to even be involved in like, well, which you know, forceps are you going to use? Which are you going to use a laser for? Just give me the best.
That's right.
That's right. Now, in a lot of your YouTube videos, you really kind of try to explain different technologies to patients. So would you consider yourself more like an early adopter of these technologies? Are you a little bit slower to adopt?
I'd say we're early adopters, and I enjoy that. Now, I'm not super early, so I don't do any research whatsoever. Okay. I publish basically nothing other than if somebody asks me to write an article, I'll write an article about my personal experience with procedures or devices. But we adopt FDA-approved technologies early. And I think that's I'm comfortable with that. I don't like to be a late adopter either.
Yeah, somewhere in the middle. You don't want to be like too cutting edge. Let me see a few results first from other surgeons.
Right.
Let me pick the brains of my colleagues. Now, there's an interesting video you showed actually at a meeting here, which was IOL exchange with an open capsule.
Right.
And so you had a beautiful way of doing that. In fact, I want that video to feature on Cataract Coach because it was done so beautifully. But most of us are kind of afraid of that situation. But the part that surprised me the most was swapping one multifocal for the other. Because normally I think if a patient is dissatisfied with the multifocal, let me just put it, when I do an IOL exchange, I'll do a monofocal.
Right.
But tell me that thought process, because that's counterintuitive to me.
This is kind of a philosophical explanation. There's this fellow on YouTube who's a retired Navy SEAL. His name is Jocko Willink. He has this video entitled Good, which basically is kind of a stoic philosophy of whenever something bad happens, you can find the good in it. So, for example, when we use the femtosecond laser, I would get anterior capsule extensions from the anterior capsule orexis. They would migrate posteriorly, and I would have to learn to manage putting single piece acrylic lenses into a open capsular bag. And then when the Synergy lens came out about in 2019, 2020, somewhere in that, we put in a bunch of them. We were early adopters. I put in about 400. And then I found that the patients were seeing okay, but they hated their vision. They said, I can't see their drive. I can't see leaves on trees. So I put 400 in, and a lot of times I would just do a capsulotomy. And then I found out, they still don't like their vision, even though they're plano, everything looks perfect.
Right.
And so I had to take those lenses out and put in a different lens. Usually I would put in like a Vivity, a Symphony, or a Panoptics to replace it. And they were very happy. And I made maybe like 10 videos on that topic. So through those complications, even though it was a lot of frustration for our patients, it was a learning experience. It's an educational experience for me where I got good at managing weird complications, and I got good at managing lens exchanges in the presence of an open capsule. And then that led to I would see a lot of patients with negative dysphotopsia with single piece acrylic lenses. And I learned how to exchange those or do reverse optic capture with those. So every problem was actually leading me to adding more skill to my toolbox so I could help salvage very frustrated patients. So it actually made me better in the end.
Yeah, it's so interesting. You took you saw the good in the complication from a femtosecond laser, split open posterior capsule. Let me see if I can manage this. And then as you're right, a lot of these newer technology lenses only come in at the single piece acrylic platform.
Right.
So you have to have them in the bag. You can't sulcus place them.
That's right.
So of those 400, how many do you think you explanted?
By 30 or 40 of them.
Wow, that's a pretty high rate. 10% is pretty high.
Yeah, but I learned what I could do and what patients liked as an alternative lens. On a bright note, we've been using the Odyssey lens recently, and it seems to work very well. Patients seem to really like it. I haven't had a patient who does not like it.
Interesting. That's very interesting. Yeah. You've tried all the technologies I see. Like you have videos of the bifocal kind of like split optic lens too, right?
Yeah, the Clearview 3 by LensTech. No financial interest in any of these companies, but it seems to be the LensTech, it's a bifocal lens, and it gives you near and far and mid-range vision and very good night vision. So unlike the diffractive optics, patients see well at night. In fact, I've taken out 4 panoptics lenses in patients who said, I don't like my quality of vision at day or night. I took out the panoptics, put in a Clearview, and they go, this is great. It works well.
So you don't have like a fastball that you love, let's say for a presbyopic IOL. Well, you just kind of offer all of them.
I migrate. I test everything, and then I find out, we kind of base our decisions based on the unhappy patients whose problems we have to solve. Right. So if I find that I have to explain a lot of lenses of a certain type, then I kind of shy away from it. In our practice, the way we charge, it's kind of like Amazon free shipping. We charge a set fee for refractive lens exchange or premium cataract surgery, and we tell them that fee covers all surgery for the following year. It could be a lens exchange, it could be YAG capsulotomy, it could be LASIK, whatever. So I just know going in, if they're not happy, I'll fix it.
It's an interesting model to do, but then how do you prevent patients from saying, well, I want a lens exchange too easily? What, the patient's becoming too fickle, like not giving it time, like, no, let me swap it. And then what if they want a second lens exchange? I don't like this one either.
Yeah, I don't play along with them at a certain point. So at some point I'll go, I think based on my experience, you need to choose either A or B. You have A, B, maybe better, maybe not better. I can't promise you anything. And I tell them, everything is about probabilities. I'll say, maybe there's like a 50% chance you'll be better. There's a 50% chance if I switch to this other lens, you'll be no better. So kind of consider that. So I just level with the patient.
What percent then of like across the spectrum, any IOL design, any presbyopic lens design, would you say you have to do IOL exchange for?
We've used the most panoptics lenses. I find I take out about 2% of them due to unsatisfactory vision. And then we replace it with various IOLs. There's so many options these days.
Yeah, I think it's good. We're getting more and more options. But then the tough part is like, okay, patient comes in, how do I decide kind of what's best?
Yeah, I'd say these days, I mean, as of the date of this conversation, which is July 17th, 2024, I would say if somebody wants a presbyopia correcting lens, I would go with the Clearview number one.
Wow.
If they're a candidate. And then number two would probably be the Odyssey. Number three would be the Panoptics. Then everything else is kind of equally distributed after that. Light adjustable, Symphony. I don't do a whole lot of just purely astigmatic correcting IOLs. It's mainly premium or basic in my practice.
So you're doing a lot then of presbyopic IOLs.
As many as we can. I think that's where the growth is.
In the we actually heard at that same meeting an Italian surgeon saying that he does 100% of patients get a presbyopic IOL because he says, how am I not going to address the presbyopia?
He says, yeah,
basically he's addressing the astigmatism.
I don't force people to do anything. I give them a choice. And if they want a basic IOL, they just want what their insurance covers, I'm happy to do that. But our practice, and see, my personal practice is probably about 60% premium IOL, 40% monofocal, something like that. Maybe 65, 35, something like that.
And then a very large portion of those, 60 who choose are end up doing basically a presbyopic IOL as opposed to like an EDOF or
monofocal. Correct. I don't use much Vivity We use some light adjustable lens, but not a lot. I use some Symphony for post dark AIs, and I think you've posted some videos on that thread. But you know, it's interesting. I would say the past 3 months, I have not seen that many post dark AIs, whereas during the prior 25 years, I would see RKIs coming in wanting surgery or having cataract surgery, needing cataract surgery, probably every other day. Yeah, now I haven't seen one in a few weeks. So it used to be I'd do post RKIs one every OR day, at least. Now I haven't done a post RKI in a month. It's interesting. Well, so I think they're aging out. I think they're aging out.
Oh, that could be part of the thing too. Because I guess I finished doing RK kind of, let's say, early 90s maybe.
Yeah, probably like 95. So that's, you know, almost 30 years ago. So they're kind of aging out.
No, because they probably had it done when they're 30-ish, like your average LASIK patient at 35. And then this is 35 years later, they're 70.
Maybe. I mean, have you noticed that at all? Have you noticed a decrease in RK?
I mean, as you know, making videos gets a lot of patients in the door.
Yes.
And so I have so many videos, even though my videos are not even aimed at patients, they're aimed at other ophthalmologists showing you a cataract coach video about cataract surgery and RKI. Then patients find this through all these searches. And so I probably do 1 to 3 RKI cataract surgeries a week.
Okay, got it.
So I'm probably 100 plus, maybe in a year, somewhere in this range.
Yeah.
But I haven't seen any fewer. Like my OR day this week, I had 2, which is pretty common for me. So I've not seen a decline yet. But then again, LA was also a hotbed of RK. It was huge in LA at the time, especially because all the movie industry, no one wanted to wear all the Hollywood stuff. No one wanted to wear corrective lenses, whether contacts or glasses. So they all had it done.
Did you ever imagine in your life that you would be making YouTube videos and that people from all over the world would travel to come see you based on your YouTube videos, and that you could just create a whole practice based off your referrals from your own YouTube videos? Did you ever imagine that?
It never in my wildest dreams. That's the crazy part, right?
But it's happening, right? That's reality for you, right?
Yeah, every consult day, there's at least one, if not 2 or 3 patients with suitcases in my clinic.
Wild.
Yeah.
It's wild.
Yeah, it is very wild. So it's an interesting phenomenon. You know, patients have a desire for this education. So that's why I think your videos are particularly like great, because you do a little longer form. A cataract coach obviously is just aimed at surgeons, and it's always about 5 minutes. It just kind of cut right to it. But yours are even longer format, and they're actually super interesting. In fact, I even like your non-patient. I like the day of the light video. That's probably one of my favorite videos you did.
Yeah, that was a long one.
That was awesome.
That was a long one. Yeah, thanks for watching that.
No, it's fantastic, because it just kind of showed, okay, here's you have obviously a very busy life and how your day goes. You, like me, you wake up, you know, old dark 30, as we'd say.
Yeah.
And so, you know, in the working out, I mean, that big Jocko influence, I noticed that too.
Yeah. You know, part of that day in the life is I see so many of these ophthalmologists on social media, and they're kind of like glamorizing, there's a bit of narcissism in their messaging, as if they just want to say, look at me, or look at the great decisions or the challenges that I've had to overcome, and I'm so honored to do XYZ. But I found it to be a little artificial. So again, I wanted to make a video of, hey, this is real life. You have to prepare, and it's kind of a grind, and you're on the move, and there's a lot of detail. And this really, it's just you get in the zone and you go. But I just wanted to keep it real.
Right. I mean, social media is a crazy thing, and I'm sure they're going to tell us in 10 or 20 years it was as bad as smoking cigarettes or something.
No, I think your videos will age well, and I think my videos will age well.
No, I think for sure. But I mean, one of my challenges now, I've started maybe 2 years ago cross-posting all my videos to Instagram. The problem with Instagram is, though, if you watch your decay, like in a YouTube video, I kind of have to show the good part or something interesting within 30 seconds, otherwise I lose the person, or maybe a minute. Instagram, the decay is rapid. If you don't show the good part within 3 seconds, they swipe. Yeah.
Yes, exactly.
It's like hyper fast.
Yeah. By the way, I haven't looked at your channel to count the number of views that each video gets, but I like every weekend I see your podcasts interviewing, you know, where you're having conversations with other ophthalmologists, and I watch those and I learned so much from those. I'm 56 right now. I learned so much, and I think to myself, why are younger ophthalmologists not watching those? Because you can learn so much from these, from the wisdom of the giants.
Right.
And they're going to have to reinvent the wheel, whereas you're giving it to them, and these giants in our field are giving them wonderful wisdom in an hour on a weekend. If you just watch that, you'll learn more from those podcasts than the surgical videos, because the podcasts kind of talk about life and career and how you make decisions and kind of how history changes over time. I mean, we can all learn how to do a capsular excis. Sure. We can all learn how to chop, hopefully. But the wisdom of people who have achieved so much is priceless.
It's amazing. I learned so much from it, right? I'm like you, mid-career, we're close to the same age. They're amazing podcasts. I learned so much. And I start putting little 5-second commercials within my surgical videos to say, hey, if you're not listening to my podcast, you are so missing out. Literally, the purpose of the podcast is to teach you the secrets to success. That's the purpose.
Yeah. And so much of ophthalmology is not just the medicine or the surgery. It's interacting with other people, communicating, leadership, managing a practice, learning how to evolve and develop emotional intelligence in how we communicate with our staff, our peers, our seniors, our patients. And we learned that through these podcasts.
Yeah, it's been a fun format. Right now we're getting probably about 1,000 video views per, but we get more than 10x that on audio streams. So it's picking up, but I think most people don't watch the actual video part. They actually just listen to the podcast in audio form.
Got it. So,
but it's a fantastic, the fun project to do. I certainly I enjoyed your podcast. So when I was on yours, it's got to be 2-3 years by now.
That's right. In this very room. Yeah.
Oh, fantastic. Well, that's a beautiful clinic you built. That's a whole other story, but no, it's the podcast. I think it's a great learning format. And the nice part is that it's just a natural conversation. It's not rushed. You can take as long as you want.
Yeah.
So tell us about your new clinic. Because if people haven't seen, you have a beautiful video on your YouTube channel about your clinic. It is probably the most beautiful ophthalmology clinic I've ever seen.
Oh, you're very kind. Well, I mean, we wanted to build our practice and build our reputation. And so my dad started our practice in 1969. He retired 2019. But it was kind of my vision that I wanted to take our practice as a second generation ophthalmologist kind of to a new level. Right. And so we bought real estate in the Beverly Hills of Austin, Texas.
Sure.
And it's on a main thoroughfare here in Austin. And we wanted to build our own surgery center and we're kind of branding ourselves. We're kind of like the Louis Vuitton of eye care, and there's a demand for those things as well. And then we have two offices. Let me rewind a little bit. In 2019, we had two offices. One was built in 1972, okay, and the other was built in 2000. And by the year 2020, I realized, oh, wow, our offices are getting old. And you kind of see, actually, it's my kids. They would say, your offices look a little old. And I kind of go, well, I could kind of put a little paint here and change some cabinetry here. But then I thought, well, you only live once, let's go big. And yeah. and it's kind of an investment diversification aspect. I thought, well, it would be nice to own real estate that we occupy. So a lot of ophthalmologists, as you know, they'll buy real estate and like, and there's nothing wrong with it. We all know tons that do, who buy real estate in like Colorado or Utah, and they travel and they have a second home and they spend maybe a month there, a year. And I thought, hell, I'm in my office so much.
Right.
Let's build a really nice office. So we renovated, we made this office and opened in 2021 and then vacated the office that we had occupied since 1972 with my dad. And then our other office that was built in 2000, once we built this office, we renovated that one. So now we have two brand new offices and it just feels better.
Yeah, you got some neat touches there too, like the huge TV wall, which is so like spectacular in person. But I'll tell you my favorite thing though is that big sphere, the big chrome sphere. It's right. Amazing. I don't know how you thought of this.
It's kind of like a knockoff of that bean in Millennium Park in Chicago.
Yeah.
That silver bean. I love that.
Yeah, so if people don't know, it's like, I mean, it's a huge, how big is this in diameter?
It's just like 7 feet.
Oh, it's like a little more than 2 meters, but it's a massive sphere. I mean, people like stop their car and take pictures in front of it.
It's on Google Maps as a landmark.
As a point of interest there. That's fantastic. Yeah. So in your clinic, you're offering the full spectrum of ophthalmology then? Or are you doing cataract refractive only?
Just, yeah, we evolved. So when I came out and practiced, I practiced like a resident. I did everything, comprehensive, fit contacts, glasses. We had our optical. I took vision plans, took call in the emergency rooms. And then as I got smarter or I learned from my peers or people who were more senior, I learned the best investment of our time as an ophthalmologist is actually doing surgery.
Right.
And the best investment of our time doing surgery is probably doing refractive cataract surgery, premium cataract surgery. So that's kind of how we've evolved over time. And now we've hired optometrists who do a majority of our primary eye care and treat our medical eye care patients. And most of my time is just seeing preoperative evaluations for patients who come in specifically wanting surgery. And then I see post-ops who are unhappy. All the happy post-ops stay with the optometrists. I only see the unhappy post-ops.
That's a little stressful, though. You know, you got a whole afternoon of unhappy post-ops.
Well, as you get better, you get fewer unhappy post-ops. But now what we're seeing is a lot of people, they fly in for like a second opinion. Like I had a patient come today from, she said she's from Pomona, California.
Okay.
And she had a panoptics lens in both eyes. She was like a minus 50 myopic miss. But the doctor there didn't do any touch-up surgery. So she saw one of my videos and flew out and saw me. And then I said, hey, you can go back to LA and have Uday do your surgery or somebody out there. And she wanted to just stay here and she'll come back out and have a LASIK surgery for a minus half sphere that the doctor out in Pomona didn't want to do.
Are you going to aim for a plan or are you going to aim for plus a quarter?
Either one. It's a win-win. Yeah,
I'd do plus a quarter.
Plus a quarter. Give her better.
I've had to do it for a patient of mine as well. So panoptics ended up minus a half. They're just not happy enough. And right. So I want to make sure we just nail that distance. And so if they a panoptics at plus a half is much happier than a panoptics at minus a half.
100% agree.
Yeah. So it's just kind of, yeah, that's one of the things we're talking here, just getting used to all these technologies and these. And how do you use them in your clinic? And so, yeah, we learn stuff the hard way. Yeah, for those patients who do travel, it's a very interesting type. Sometimes those patients, though, are a little more intense in their research. I mean, pages of notes.
Totally. Yeah, I had a gentleman, another gentleman, he's from California. He's from the LA area. Now I know. You didn't do a surgery, but one of your colleagues that you will know, but I won't mention their name, did their surgery, put in a light adjustable. No, they put in an Eyhance. I put in a light adjustable lens plus, he actually, he's 20/20 with a light adjustable lens plus, but he read something about the design of the LAL plus.
Okay.
And he said, I'm getting a little distortion. And it was his idea. He said, could we take out my light adjustable lens plus and put in a regular light adjustable lens? His theory was that will fix his problem. He came up with that theory.
Oh boy.
And I did it. I did it. He had an open capsule. He's very happy. In fact, on the table, he said, I know I'm Plano. We're in surgery, about to start. He goes, I know I'm Plano, but I think I like to be a little farsighted. Can you adjust the lens power so I'll be a little lens farsighted? This is just, so I, instead of like a plus 20.5, I put in a plus 20.
Yeah.
And he emailed me back. He goes, this is great. It's perfect. Wow. So his theory, these people do their research. Yeah. I didn't even think about that. Amazing.
So what was it? I guess the increased little curvature that he didn't like?
Yeah, or? The little bump he thinks creates a little distortion. And he is so perfectionistic, yes.
That's oh God, that's a tough one there.
I mean, that'll be a video. I'm going to exchange a LAL plus for LAL. Is the patient happy? I already have the video. I'm going to make that video.
Wow, that is just wild. But they got to be careful. You get into the point where I kind of don't want the patients to dictate, like, oh, doctor, I just want you to do the surgery. I'm going to tell you what to do. Here's what you need to do.
But his theory was actually credible.
Yeah.
It worked. I mean, I know you're absolutely correct. We don't want to be drawn into what the patient wants.
Right.
If it's against our better judgment. Yeah, totally.
Yeah. In fact, here in LA, I've actually kind of shied away from revision surgery for other patients because sometimes they have a surgery done with whatever reason they're not happy. They go and do a ton of Google homework. I mean, they come into your office as junior ophthalmologists. And then their expectations for the revision surgery are so high that it's like, you know, do you not understand? This is not like virgin tissue anymore. This is like, you can't have that same expectation.
So do you, if a patient calls your office and says, I had surgery elsewhere and I'm not happy, will you see that patient?
My office actually tells the patient to email me and reach out to me. And I do it on a case by case basis, but I'd say more likely not, that it's hard to fix other people's complications because again, patients now have unrealistic expectations and a revision surgery is kind of never as pretty as the original surgery.
Yeah, I agree. And I spoke with a colleague of mine at the ACOS meeting who feels the same way you feel it. He said that those patients take too much of his time. So he's not going to see patients who've had surgery elsewhere as a second opinion. I see it as two ways where I continue to see second opinions. Number one, I actually learn a lot by solving these little problems. And then secondly, I won't do their surgery. It's usually they want a different type of refractive lens.
Mm-hmm.
So I will charge them a lot as a disincentive for them to do their surgery. And I'll encourage them to go see the original ophthalmologist. But if they choose to see me because it takes so much of my time, I will charge commensurate with the amount of time and stress that it takes to fix these people.
Makes a lot of sense. I mean, that's particularly challenging. And then again, with all your videos out there, it just draws more and more patients. They're like, I'm going to come see this guy. And I'm sure you get people from all over the country come to see you.
Yeah, it's pretty wild, but it's somehow it works out. I mean, it's manageable.
Right. Interesting stuff. I mean, I'm kind of interested to see where this goes with the patients. You're getting more and more patients now who are learning about technologies and social media and then coming in. Like, and a good example is I was scrolling Reddit, and obviously some cookies on my computer obviously know that I am Googling everything eye stuff. And so all the ads I get in my Reddit scroll, they're like all ophthalmology. I get Vizient ICL ads like every day in my Reddit scroll. So now even the companies are going to the social media to kind of go direct to patient, direct to social media messaging.
Social media is so powerful. I don't even know the impact. I do not know the impact of Instagram or TikTok or Facebook marketing because I don't do those things. I mean, I'll post things on those three platforms, but I actually don't think I've ever gotten a patient through those. Do you know if those, if you've had any kind of,
it's essentially YouTube what's doing it for my, you know, my patient referrals. Facebook, I actually don't post to at all. I mean, my cataract coach stuff posts automatically every day. The cataract coach, YouTube, Facebook, LinkedIn, Insta, all post automatically every day. So that I do have a post every day on Facebook, but I don't actually go and look at Facebook at all.
And importantly, I think, well, I don't know how, if people go on Instagram or those social media platforms to search for things, but your videos will come up there. Your videos are like evergreen. So somebody searching for a problem, they'll stumble on one of your videos or it'll come up as a recommended video when they're watching some other video. So I think YouTube is kind of the best investment of social media time.
Right, because first it's owned by Google. Mm-hmm. And then Google now in searches ranks videos high. Because like for me, if I want to look up how to do something, I'm older than my kids. I'll look up, let's say, how to, you know, connect a battery tender in my car, how to change it, whatever it is. I'll look up an instruction list. Whereas my kids would look up a video. And so I think now the YouTube is really, Google has really prioritized the YouTube videos in the searches. So now you search for anything, the first thing that comes up are videos.
And they're so powerful. Video is more, you know, the patients are kind of, unlike a website, the patients will find your video and they will kind of get to know you through your video. In fact, I mean, I remember, this is when, I think even when you were before you're in your current practice, you posted a video and you were just talking to a patient and the way you communicated, I go, that's a really good way to communicate. And it's like we have a little, like if I didn't know you, in fact, I probably didn't know you at the time. I felt like, he seems like he knows what he's doing. You get a emotional little bond with the person through YouTube that you can't get through a website.
Right. Yeah. You know, patients are coming out of town. They see you and they're like eyes light up like, oh, I know him. Feels like they know you, which is. Yes. But then again, I'm also super careful. I do not post personal stuff up there at all.
Right. The internet is forever.
Right. And then so many people watching. It's just like, holy, it's a big mess there.
No, like when I'm making a video, I actually type up a little script and I review the script and then I think about it and I say it. And I'm always kind of like editing myself because I realize how's that going to be misconstrued or how might what I state be misconstrued and misinterpreted and potentially used against me. That's so I'm very careful.
Well, I had actually experienced recently, there was a cataract coach video where I reviewed a resident case, a U.S. resident, anonymous. I literally don't know who the resident's name. I don't know the name. 200 plus cases in. This is essentially the last case of your residency. And it was horrendous. And so I gave a truthful, honest, like a little bit harsh criticism of this. Like, how do you finish your training with this? How did this happen? And oh my gosh. First, it was very popular. It got 10,000 views and more than 100 comments in like 48 hours. But I took a lot of criticism because then I guess a lot of the younger generation is like, no, you have to encourage them more and be nice and be. And I listen, I want to encourage everyone. I'm teaching you for free. I'm giving you all the secrets, but at some point you got to take responsibility. Then I thought, you know, maybe it's a difference in generation. I went back and the video's still up, but I took all the audio out and replaced it with a Mozart track.
Oh, okay. I'm reminded of, I'm a big fan of Nick Saban. I don't know if you know who he is. He's in Alabama. He's the retired University of Alabama Crimson Tide football coach. I think he's won like 7 national championships. Have you ever heard of him? Nick Saban?
He rings a bell.
Okay. So he's all over social media because he's had so much success running that football program. And there's a clip where he's yelling at his football players during practice. And then it segues to a interviewer saying, "Why are you so hard on your players?" And his reply is, "I don't really think I'm being hard. I don't really think that's a fair statement. The way I see it is we have a standard here at Alabama, and it's my job to hold people accountable to that standard." Mm-hmm. You know, and so when you're saying what you're saying, I saw that video. I thought you were very fair. And really, as a patient, I would not want somebody with low talent working on my eye.
Right.
I would not want a reckless, unprepared, unaware apathetic surgeon. Yes. Undriven, unmotivated surgeon operating on my eye. So that's the standard. The standard is you want somebody who is trying to be excellent every day and putting in the work every day to deliver the best outcomes for each patient. That's the standard. And that person wasn't up to that standard. And if it hurts their feelings, well, they just need to get better. They need to put in the work.
I agree with you 100%, but I think there's a huge gap in the difference between the two generations. I think it's a different story now. It's just it's too many participation trophies. It's not enough excellence.
You know, it's politically incorrect, but I don't think certain things will age well. Like all this hand holding, and you may see it in social media these days, but all this, this video may be canceled for what I'm about to say, but all this DEI stuff, it's just not going to age well, because really, I think it should be merit, MEI, merit, excellence, intelligence. If I want to hire somebody, I want them for merit, excellence, intelligence. Absolutely. If I want to go see a surgeon to cut on my body, I want merit, excellence, intelligence. I don't care what they are, if they're
No criteria matters to me other than, which is good. If you're flying my plane, I hope you're really a brilliant pilot. And the rest I don't care about.
I don't care. I just want you to be a good human and really crush it at what you're supposed to do.
Right.
And I think people, that is going to age well. But all this, hey, I lowered the standards. So, you know, you even see it. I mean, this is kind of I'll tiptoe around politics a little bit, but you know, they're examining the Secret Service because their preparation for what almost happened on Saturday while we were at ACOS, it reveals just incredible negligence on preparation and staffing. And it's kind of like, well, if you don't put merit, excellence, and intelligence as your criteria, you might have problems. And I think they had problems this weekend.
Yeah, I think we're seeing that across the board here. So it's but I think you're right. We look back at this, pendulum always swings back. Pendulum swing back. You'll have to just wait it out, I guess. But I'm with you. I believe in straight up merit.
Yep, truth. I'm for truth. That's all.
Pleasure to come to me having surgery. Now, speaking of having surgery, you are pseudophakic in at least one eye.
In this eye, yes. So I know you're like a minus two myope, right? Something like that.
Oh, the best thing ever. Here you go. I love minus two.
Well, I was just presbyopic and I needed reading glasses and I hated it. You know, you have the psychological barriers you have to overcome on getting old. And then here we are putting in premium lens implants and I can't read the near card as well as the patient that has back at the time, like a panoptics lens. And so, yeah, I kind of just, I know how safe it is. And in my opinion, I thought, well, I couldn't have it any better. I know the staff, I know the equipment, I know the doctor, I know all the variables. Life has risk, but reading glasses suck. And I said, I'm going to do this. So I had Dr. John Odette, my partner, do the surgery. I have a Symphony lens in this eye. And I rarely, if ever, use reading glasses. You know, and I'm amazed that when we go to these ophthalmology meetings and we're talking about presbyopia correcting lenses, and almost very few of those speakers have had any IOL surgery.
Right.
And they're recommending it. So I'm going and going, well, you know, kind of, you can do it. It works. It really does. You know, the natural lens gets worse as we age, and these lens implants, though they're not perfect, they work pretty well.
Did you aim for a little bit of minus then in your
I'm a
medium?
minus a half here, and I'm
Okay.
kind of plano, probably drifting hyperopic here, probably plus a quarter here. So I can see far because this eye carries me, and I see near because this eye carries me.
Oh, so now, what would you do for me? I'm stuck. I'm your age, let's say. I'm a minus two sphere, and I love my near vision.
I'd put in like a Clearview lens or an Odyssey lens, and I
You
think
don't
you'd do
have to.
fine. I think you'd be fine. But you, just like anything, you have to be driven. I don't tell people, I don't try to like push
Yeah, no, for
anything
sure.
on anybody.
Yeah, I'm just so spoiled with such amazing near vision, though I'm presbyopic.
But
And
when you're
so I'm
out and about, you have to, you're on and off, right? Are you wearing progressives or no?
No. I have a big nose, ethnic nose, and I have very small glasses that I just look under. And so to see, I just look under them. It's awesome.
Whatever makes you happy, whatever works for you is a-okay.
Yeah, that's the hope. But you're right, though. You go to all these meetings, you see all the senior ophthalmologists putting on their readers, and meanwhile they're teaching about presbyopic IOLs.
Yeah, there's something that doesn't add up there, but that's okay.
Well, you're also a big believer. I think you did LASIK for your kids, right? Or one of your kids.
Oh my gosh, I've done so much surgery. This is, I mean, I've done surgery on my wife, my parents, my brother, my brothers, my in-laws. Yeah. So it's the mindset. I think they talked about this at ACOS. It's the mindset. I remember I asked because I saw my father when he was practicing ophthalmology, he would operate on family members. And I go, why would you do that? What if something went wrong? And he said, well, I feel like if something goes wrong, I'm best equipped to handle it or prevent it. And
Sure.
I would rather be in that position than refer them out. And if something went wrong, maybe I could have prevented it. So I kind of incorporated that mindset. So, and
Well,
it's a good mindset because then you have the mindset of I'm going to challenge myself to perform at the highest standards such that I can operate on anybody and I'll know that I can avoid, prevent, or correct anything that goes on. And you challenge that as a, if you're a younger ophthalmologist, kind of pretend that everybody is your closest loved one and hold yourself to that standard of can you do their surgery? And if you hold that yourself to that standard all your career, you'll continuously get better. So even now, like if I operate on just a white cataract off a person who's in poverty, I treat them the same as if I'm treating a billionaire. They get the same VIP treatment, but everybody, so again, merit, excellence, intelligence. I'm trying to practice at the highest level, at the highest standard all the time. And that's how you can more comfortably operate on family.
yeah, for sure. No, I've done surgery for both of my parents, so same way as you. But for me, it's just like the one golden rule. I give the same high level of care and treatment that I'd want for my eyes or my family's eyes. That's it. Everyone gets that.
Totally. You've got so many good sayings that I remember, and you say them in your videos, but that's one of them.
Yeah, you have to. I think it's really important to be able to do that. Now, we got to give some good pearls for the young ophthalmologists who are smart enough to listen to this podcast. What is your opening line when you walk into the room for with me, meet a patient? What do you say?
I introduce myself as like if you're my patient, I go, I would see your name on a piece of paper as I walk in the door, and I would say, hi, Uday, I'm Shannon. Nice to meet you. It's very simple, nothing fancy. I used to be big on you know, when I'm when I when we were both younger, I used to insist on doctor. Now I don't really care about titles. I just say I'm Shannon, and I call them by their first name. And then, realistically, I mean, pragmatically, we've built a great team that supports us. So our team has at every touch point kind of prepared the patient. So when I'm in there, I'm really dialed in on reviewing the data and then making a recommendation and then asking if they have any questions. That's another point. Like when we were both younger, I was taught you have to see 30 patients in order to generate one cataract surgery. And so that was the model. And I would see patients and their families and their parents and their children 10, 20 years, and then I would do their cataract surgery. Nowadays, I've never met the person. I meet them for the first time. I do surgery. So I meet them for their pre-op. I see them during surgery, although they're under a drape, so they barely see me. And then I may never see the patient again. So it's the model has completely evolved. And so for a younger ophthalmologist, be open-minded to change and become more efficient, because as the population continues to age, a lot of ophthalmologists retire out. There's an imbalance. There's a greater demand for surgical eye care and eye care in general. And there will be a surgical ophthalmology shortage. So the future belongs to the ophthalmologists who can become more efficient. And in our practice, it's building a team, training that team, leading that team, retaining that team, helping them evolve so they support the mission of the practice, which is surgical eye care. And so that helps me to just go in and spend maybe 5 to 10 minutes with a patient, and they choose a premium IOL most of the time, and then we just execute and give them great vision.
Oh, that's fantastic. Yeah, that's the team's super important. My favorite line is, it's not really a line, I introduce myself, obviously meet the patient, but I just say, just tell me about your eyes. And then I just stay silent. Let them just talk. Let them express what their issues are. And that's one of the things that I thought really helps me, is to not interrupt the patient. Just go ahead. Just tell me everything. Tell me about your eyes.
Our staff takes down all that information, and I just read the story. And if I see something of interest, I'll repeat it to the patient. So this is what's bothering you. Okay, I got it. And then I'll just figure it out from there. The conversation's not that long. It's refreshing sometimes when I'll meet somebody and they have an interesting story, and you know, we all get stimulated by people's backgrounds and their interesting stories along the way. It keeps it fresh.
Yeah, no, for sure. I think the way to talk to patients is a tough thing to learn, because you don't really see it much in your residency, because you're like at a county hospital, VA hospital, where you're obviously talking to patients, but you're so overloaded with work that you just don't have the time to to do that.
I guess some people are born with it, but I've just learned, I guess the term is emotional intelligence. I've learned how to listen to people. You know, they say God gave you two ears and one mouth, so you should be listening more than you're talking. And, I just learned how to read people better as I've gotten older. And I think it's all those little empathy, compassion, learning communication skills that instill confidence, but reduce stress. It's all these little subtle human things that you can't. It's so important.
It's hard to read them in a book. Some of these things you have to learn along the way.
Yeah, you learn, but you learn it from other people who have those character attributes and execute on those things better than you. And if you're smart enough to observe it and then incorporate it into your own system, it's awesome.
Right. So it's just given a great patient experience. So that's probably one thing I love in your clinic. Obviously it's gorgeous. It's beautiful, but it's also just a really great patient experience. You really thought that through. So,
you know, you're making a big impact on how you communicate and how you express things. People, if they're wise, they key into that, like all your little sayings, you know, viscoelastic is cheaper than vitreous, or treat somebody, you know, I treat everybody. You have all these little things. I treat everybody as if they're my family. I would give them what I would give my family. You're passing on things. This is how human history becomes better, is because we pass on these great pearls of wisdom generation to generation. You hear it and you go, ah, I'm gonna make that my own and I'm gonna carry it forward. We've all learned that way. That's why you've kind of featured some of your mentors along the way.
Oh, for sure.
You know, Bobby Osher and all that stuff.
The Godfather. He's the Godfather of surgical video.
Yeah, so you learn so much and we kind of make it our own, and then we hopefully the next generation listens and learns.
I think they will. I think that, you know, the nice part is though, this next generation really has, and first they had a big challenge because they got to learn everything we learned in residency, plus all the new stuff in the last 25, 30 years, which is a lot.
That's right.
But I think, yeah, they have big challenges coming, which is going to be just massive surgical volume. And so I think what you've done is very smart, which is surgeons should focus on surgery. And that's the best use of your time.
That's right. I mean, you can do whatever you want to do. If you want to do medical ophthalmology, that's fine. But you only have one life. I you know, time is our most precious resource. You can't buy more of it. Right. So I'm very discerning on how I invest my time.
You and me both. Well, speaking of time, can you believe we've been chit-chatting for an hour already? So I can talk to you for a few more hours. As you know, we're good friends going back many years now. But I want to thank you, Shannon. What a pleasure to have you on my podcast. Learned so much today. Hopefully the young generation is going to be listening to this great podcast.
Thank you for all you do, Uday. You're awesome.
All right. And if you guys and gals want another podcast, as you know, it's every Sunday. Everywhere you find podcasts, Apple, Amazon, Google, Spotify, you name it, we got a podcast there. Plus, of course, there's a new Cataract Coach video every day. And hopefully Shannon will send me his video about that IOL exchange with open capsule, and I'll feature that tomorrow. Until next time.